I'm Debbie Draby from the Clinical Excellence Commission, and I'm pleased you can join us for this four-part series with Dr. Nick O'Connor and Dr. Catherine Turner. This podcast is part three of a four-part series on restorative just culture. In this segment, Implementation of Restorative Just Culture, Nick explores with Catherine how does responding, learning, and improving happen in a restorative just culture. Catherine provides really practical examples of implementation of restorative just culture, particularly in the review of incidents, which are guided by principles around who was hurt, exploring what needs to happen, and also thinking about whose responsibility it is to meet those needs. And it's really a conversation around engaging all stakeholders. Catherine emphasizes really the importance of involving both families and clinicians, particularly those who were directly involved in the incidents, as they will enable a better understanding of why things happened the way that they did. This inevitably enables healing, engages learning and improvement, because it's bridging that gap from what we often describe, that gap between from work as imagined and work as done. Clinicians and families involved in the incidents have a significant level of insight and understanding that can help generate practical and relevant recommendations and improvement ideas that really reflect what they've experienced firsthand. Catherine highlights how this is really essential and ensures that families and clinicians don't feel dismissed and they're not defensive about the incidents. And yes, what she often says, we can often learn something when this happens. I hope you enjoy this conversation.
So, Catherine, how does responding, learning, and improving happen in a restorative just health culture?
So, I guess certainly, in the model that we developed, I think, going back to the principles, of who was hurt, what do they need, whose responsibility is it to meet those needs, and engagement of all stakeholders. And I think if you, keep to those principles, that helps, drive your actions. And then sort of conceptualizing it in, the healing process, the learning process, and then the improvement process. So in terms of the healing process, we think about, well, who is hurt? The consumer, and certainly the family is hurt, but also the clinicians and the organisation. And so how do we respond to that? So we respond to, say, families through a range of measures, and that includes sort of immediately, reaching out to them, providing open and honest clinician disclosure, linking them in, say particularly for suicides, but this isn't just about suicides, for postvention support, making sure that they're getting to those agencies. But it's also the beginning of a process when we link in with families that takes us through the learning and improvement process as well. And I think that was one of the other changes that we made. We had an open disclosure process, but in many ways it seemed very disconnected from everything that we did. There was this team that would come and do an open disclosure at the end, after everything had been done. What we've shifted it to is a continuous pathway where we start with that clinician disclosure and getting them the support that they need. And sometimes that's multiple meetings. It's whatever they need, I guess, from the service. But also flagging with them that we will want them to be part of the learning process, and we're really interested in their views of what happened, their perspective of what happened, and any ideas that they've got for improvement in our service. And that then we will meet with them at the end and answer the questions that they've posed to us as part of that, process, and let them know what our learnings are, but also, very importantly, what we're going to do about it and how we're going to keep ourselves accountable for that. So if I just keep on that, the family sort of response, the learning process, now what we don't do is bring the family and the team together at that point but we do it by sort of interviewing the family separately from clinician disclosure and open disclosure, and gathering their perspectives. And sometimes their perspectives of the event and the care that led up to that will be very different from the teams. And I think that, you know, we have had, you know, such important learnings from families. And sometimes it's tough for the team to hear, you know, that different perspective as well. So we need to make sure that we do that, that they get this information in a supportive process as well. So the information from families is written up, and any questions that they've got or ideas for improvement. And then that is presented to the team that does the review. And nearly always has it led to, you know, important recommendations and actions in our service. And then, you know, the open disclosure process sort of at the end of that. In terms of the clinicians, the healing process, so we do need to do what we've talked about before with the local response, the line manager response to this, and the leadership response, and then that peer response as well, and providing, you know, sustained support for clinicians. The other part is that we, you know, are very strongly of the view that involving the clinicians in the review process that were actually involved in the incident is so important as part of that process of learning. And that was one of the most important reasons why we wanted to move away from commissioned root cause analyses, which were more secretive, didn't have that process. And I think if you're thinking about, you know, safety two concepts and the concept of, you know, work as imagined and work as done, you really need the team there to understand really what actually happened and why actions were taken and, you know, why certain things are done in ways that may actually be very productive, but, you know, not all variation in practice it leads to harm. Sometimes it's, you know, adaptability of clinicians in the face of, you know, a lot of challenges. So I think, you know, for that reason, but we needed to create, but what we need to do is to create an environment where the clinicians absolutely feel safe to be able to reflect and don't feel defensive and can absolutely say, well, I think, you know, maybe we could do something differently about that. And the other thing about having the clinicians involved is that, you know, they are the ones who are going to have to be enacting the recommendations and making the changes to services. So engaging them in that process, getting their ideas for improvements, you know, will give us much better outcomes in terms of actual improvements to the system. We made some other changes to the way that we approached reviews, which I think for us has been really important. One is that, really importantly is the idea that let's not start with the event. Let's actually look at the whole clinical care pathway and look for opportunities, you know, regardless of the outcome, where we could improve. And I think that, and let's learn anything. So instead of just let's learn contributing factors and let's rectify that. Now, I know that this is different from traditional approaches, but in our experience, it really helped to drop the defensiveness and get people really focused on, with every part of our system, you know, how could we improve? And interestingly, the families' recommendations were often, you know, not necessarily related to the proximal issues of the, you know, the incident. They're often about relationships and, you know, communication and, you know, how we can better engage with them. There've been various recommendations that have come out of that I think wouldn't have come out if we'd approached it in that more proximal, you know, contributing factors, because you couldn't, and I think in suicide particularly, you can almost never say if we change this, you would definitely have changed the outcome. So let's not get into those arguments. You know, let's not work out whether it's a contributing factor or not. Let's actually, but you can almost always learn something that can lead to improvement in the service. So I think those sort of changes, the learn anything mantra, I guess, and that sort of forward, you know, so we actually called it the comprehensive review of the clinical care pathway rather than an incident review to change that conceptualization.
Like in the Canadian model?
Sorry, the...
Like in the Canadian model?
Well, I'm not sure actually about that, but certainly the Canadian model looked at... We did use the Canadian model in terms of the... Constellation diagram. So that seemed to be possibly helpful to look at, you know, how various, you know, aspects or, you know, of the care might connect with one another, you know, or contributing factors might connect with one another.
Okay. Look, just listening to you as you describe this, you know, we started off with the idea of how safety and harm are sort of emergent properties of complex systems. And this approach is fundamentally relational, isn't it? And so important to understand the multiple perspectives on these complex sets of interactions that have happened. Just link it back then. How does this process sort of come back to the team, the morbidity and mortality meeting, the safety and quality committee? How do you close the loops there?
Yes, so in line with safety too, I guess resilient healthcare, what we also wanted to do is to don't just look at the most severe outcomes. There's probably things that we can that give us a, you know, a lot more opportunity to learn from. So we wanted to look at a range of incidents, near misses, and also sort of less severe incidents that might have happened repeatedly in the service. So looking at multi-incident analyses as well. So one of the most important things that we did around, you know, changing culture is not easy. You know, how do you keep everyone focused on those basic principles and always coming back to that? And what we created was a triage meeting. And we actually, there was in the broader health service, there was a weekly triage meeting where we all got together, sort of surgeons and ED physicians and mental health, et cetera, to talk about all of the incidents that occurred in all the serious incidents that occurred in the HHS. And then we created that triage process within our service. And we looked at a broader range rather than the narrow reportable incidents. So we were able to set up a process where we could see anyone that touched our service for up to 12 months and died by suicide, or died actually. And we were able to look at those. We looked at suicide attempts for open consumers. And we looked at any significant event that we thought that was important to have a look at. It might be a violent incident, or it might be a, you know, non-compliance with a, you know, with the Mental Health Act or something like that. Anything that we could, you know, potentially learn from would come to this meeting of leaders of the service, and we'd have a discussion about what type of review we might want or whether it needs a review. And as I said, I think that's, you know, and who we engage in that review. So always coming back in about engagement of all stakeholders. And sometimes that's really challenging to people to say, well, no, we will involve, you know, these people that you might, you know, be a bit concerned that they are involved, you know, because of their reactions, whatever. So, you know, and sometimes we had to be, you know, quite firm about that to keep that going. So there were a range there then of types of reviews that we could do. So there was the comprehensive review, which I've basically described, and we did that for reportable incidents, but also what we called significant events. So, you know, a near miss might have been a significant event, and we would treat it just as if it was a reportable incident with all the accountability around closing the loop, etc. Some we might put, say, that they're not, they don't require a comprehensive review, but they require, you know, a review within an M&M process, for example, or a local clinical review. And simultaneously, you know, some work was done with the to make sure that sort of in each service line we had a multidisciplinary M&M, and that people were reminded of restorative just culture principles, you know, at every meeting. So, and yeah, so that, you know, I guess that's another line of work that that progressed. And then fundamentally we did, a lot of clinicians and leaders were already trained in human error and patient safety, the HEAPS approach, and looking at human factors. And although clinicians don't like the term human error, HEAPS, so we've avoided using that term, but we thought, well, if people are already trained in that, you know, what we'd do is build on that and have that as the baseline. So they used, so a local review might use the framework of a HEAPS review in doing that. So giving people some structure to do those reviews.
Thank you for listening to this podcast series with Dr. Nick O'Connor and Dr. Catherine Turner on restorative just culture. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please note this is one of a four-part series, and I hope you listen to the other three segments as Nick and Catherine continue to take us on a journey exploring their experiences and their insight into restorative just culture. This four-part series includes conversations around practical implementation of restorative just culture and what it looks like in healthcare. Catherine will share her experiences on implementing the restorative just culture framework in mental health services and the impact that this has had on the management of incidents. And she'll give some really practical examples around this. I hope you enjoy the remainder of this series. I'm Debbie Draby from the Clinical Excellence Commission, and I'm pleased you can join us in this conversation with senior leaders on the guiding principles of effective morbidity and mortality meetings in action. This podcast series aims to explore the experiences and insights from leading M&M meetings. Look out for more podcasts as we continue this conversation and clinicians share their journey and learning. I hope you find it useful, and if you'd like to contribute to this conversation, please contact me.